Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, welcome to another edition of Reconstruction, the new weekly podcast from the Construction Index with Phil Bishop and David Taylor, construction's answer to the Muppet Show's incisive and knowledgeable commentators Statler and Waldorf. That's assuming you're old enough to remember the Muppets, of course, and not everybody is. Today we're going to talk about some of the stories that have hit the headlines in the past week, some of them international, some of them national, and most of them of some interest to people in the UK. Phil, do you want to start off and broach the first topic for us?
Hello, David. Morning. Yes. Well, the three things we thought we'd look at this week. The first is the whole subject of climate emergency, which is a story every week and has been for a long time. And then we'll look at smart motorways, which were the subject of much discussion this week. And finally, you've been looking at some photos from China of a massive construction site with hundreds of diggers on it because they're needing to build a hospital in just 6 days to treat the coronavirus patients to handle that outbreak.
So, yeah, that's a very interesting little story. Yeah,
we'll get on to that later.
Yeah, okay. Well, the climate emergency used to be called climate change once upon a time. Now it's turned into an emergency. Why has it been in the news and what's its relevance to construction this week?
Well, it's always in the news, never not going to be in the news. But in terms of what we've written about on the constructionindex.co.uk this week, a report from an organisation called LETI, the London Energy Transformation Initiative, who have published a climate emergency design guide, which they suggest provides a blueprint on how the construction industry can help combat the effects of climate change. I have no statistics at my fingertips, but they say that buildings, the building process and buildings which are lived in, worked in, are major contributors to the climate emergency because of their energy consumption, because of their embedded carbon in the construction of them and in the running of buildings. And obviously, the more energy efficient a building is, the more it's made out of recycled materials, the lower its carbon footprint, the lower its environmental impact. And there are all sorts of ways that these can be done and calculations that need to be done. And there are all kinds of different trade-offs that can be made. So the idea of this report is that they've created a consensus. They've brought together, I think it's been written by 100 very normal, but roughly 100 professional engineers, architects and so on from the Royal Institute of British Architects and CIBSE, the Chartered Institution of Building Service Engineers, to provide a consensus on how we could go about designing new buildings in a way that we have a chance of hitting some of these emissions targets that the nation and various cities have set.
I've got to say, Phil, I'm sorry to jump in here, but I mean, this doesn't sound very new to me. I mean, we've known for many, many years that the built environment is the single biggest contributor to global warming. You know, that's nothing new at all. We've had God knows how many revisions of Part L of the building regulations, the bit which governs the conservation of fuel and power. We've known about this for a long time. So I don't know, is it just sort of old wine in a new bottle, or is there something genuinely new here?
I think there's an element of the screw turning, of the use of the word emergency now suggests that, hang on, we can't move at 10 miles an hour in this direction. We've got to start moving at motorway speed in this direction. And some impetus has been placed on it by various local authorities, particularly the big cities, London, Edinburgh, Birmingham and others have set a target to be carbon neutral by 2030, which I keep looking at the numbers 2030 and thinking, oh, that's miles away. It's only 10 years away.
Yes, it'll be on us in no time.
Absolutely. So the local authorities are often either the client or they give the planning permission to building projects. then if they have these policies, firm policies in place, then the builders, the designers have to really up their game. And it's not just the it's not just the designs of buildings. Some of our big construction companies are stepping in up to the plate here as well. They've all been trying to reduce their waste and recycle more, partly because it sounds good, but mostly because it saves them money and it's good business sense. So they've all been doing on this path for a number of years. But just in the recent weeks and months, we've had Skanska UK saying that they're going to be carbon neutral throughout the entire supply chain by 2045. That's a 25-year goal. And that's not just, they're not just saying, this is what we're going to do. They're saying, this is what we're going to do, and everyone who expects to work for us is going to damn well do it as well.
And have they explained how that's going to happen?
I haven't read the details of that. It's a target, but the way it will be done. If I could give you another example of Waits, who are talking at Waits Group, another major contractor, and they've got a 15-year target, 2025, to produce zero carbon from its operations. I'm not sure if that's net zero or absolute zero. Now the difference with the net zero, of course, is that you are still producing or emitting carbon or embedded carbon. But as long as you plant enough trees or pay some
That's how you do it. You plant a few trees.
pay someone a bunch of money to sit at home and not go on an aeroplane, or however offsetting works. So that there is a commitment to offsetting, which is only partially cheating. I mean, it's better than not offsetting. I mean, Mott MacDonald is a consulting engineer. They're saying they're going to be net zero carbon neutral by the end of this year.
Oh, right.
Quite a deal. Converting all their offices to renewable energy, only hiring electric or hybrid vehicles where possible, and trying to stop their employees getting on aeroplanes.
But Mott MacDonald doesn't build anything, does it?
They don't drive. They don't drive diggers, they don't pour concrete. They tend to be office bound, even if it's site offices. And yes, it's slightly easier than for a Skanska or a Waits Group. But still, even though there's an element of, I love trees, planting trees, great, as long as the right sort of trees in the right sort of places. But even though it's things like planting trees and eliminating single-use plastic and driving hybrid or electric cars, all of that is quite an easy win that you can pretty much do this year. It's only part of the wider picture, but it's all indicative of how the entire construction industry is moving, and pretty much all in the right direction. We also had a piece in your magazine recently about the move of electric, battery powered and cable powered construction machinery is all taking off.
Indeed, yes, and you wrote it, I think.
Oh, so I did.
A lot is happening actually in construction plant. All the big manufacturers seem to be jumping on this bandwagon and really committing themselves to it. A lot of money being spent on R&D. So it is being taken seriously, but I'm still a little bit, maybe I'm cynical, I don't know. You know, the phrase greenwash tends to spring to my lips, you know, because it's so easy for somebody to say we're going to offset our carbon emissions and reduce our carbon footprint and use all the usual buzz phrases and, I don't know, maybe employ an accountant to do the offsetting for them. And I wonder, when you boil it all down to the bare bones, actually what practical contribution does it make? And can you actually measure it? Can you actually say we are genuinely carbon neutral? We're not emitting more carbon than we're absorbing. I doubt that you can actually do that. It has to be a sort of a wet finger in the wind and you know, your best guess. I don't know what you feel about that. Do you think it's a little bit more substantial than that?
Well, I've got several thoughts on that. First one is that I'm not even going to question the scientists. Unlike some people, I've got a lot of time for experts, and I think most of them know more than I do. However, I do think there's a butter margarine element here. Many years ago, I remember being told, maybe whether it's by advertisers or my mother, I can't remember, that margarine was better than butter, healthier. Now we know that's palpable nonsense, and that you don't have to cut the fat off your bacon. Fat doesn't make you fat. Sugar makes you fat. And all these things which we took as scientific truisms 30 years ago or 40 years ago, we now know that they're either wrong or not quite as simple as we thought. And I suspect a lot of the climate change science is an evolving science, but I don't dispute the general drift of it.
No.
My second point is that while all these things of putting in double glazing, lagging aloft, or a drop in the ocean, that's what it takes. We need a gazillion drops in the ocean. And as long as we keep putting a drop in the ocean, if I'm not using a dangerous metaphor, we might get there. At least if we don't, we won't. My final thought is my cynicism extends to big business, not just big construction, but whether it's big Coca-Cola or big Levi Jeans or whoever it is. Whenever they say, oh, we're going to save the planet because the children are our future and we care and our employees are our number one priority, I immediately said, oh, hogwash, you just want to make money. And fair play, every business's first job is to make money. But if they're buying an electric digger because it makes them more money, because that's what the local authority client is demanding, or for whatever the reason is that they're doing it, they're doing it. So I don't care why they're doing it, as long as they're doing it.
No. So the motivation isn't really the issue. It's a net effect, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yes. So incremental gains. That's what we're talking about here, rather than a big breakthrough.
I also think that people of our generation, I mean, listeners may have gathered that we're the wrong side of 50. Anyway, I find it easier to get agitated by the micro environmental damage that I see around, rather than the macro, the invisible melting ice caps. I'm aware of, I know it's a bad thing, and I understand it's a bad thing, but on a daily basis, I'm more riled by litter and graffiti on the one hand, and our non-repairable, disposable culture, where if your telly breaks down, it's cheaper to chuck it away and buy a new one than to get it fixed.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same. I'm personally more worried about waste. Waste in the construction industry is a big problem, as we know. It's costly, it's environmentally damaging, and it's. I think that we can make really appreciable strides towards tackling that one. That I think in terms of the environmental impact that construction has, that is an issue where we ought to be concentrating our efforts.
I'm going to stick up for the construction industry on this point, and maybe it's a lot to do with the landfill tax that's made it expensive to chuck things in skips, and there's an economic imperative that's been imposed upon them. But the construction industry and the demolition industry have been pioneers at recycling, reusing the waste that they create. And I gather you've written something recently on recycling of building products.
Indeed I have, yes. Very interesting story, actually. Scientists up at Heriot-Watt University in Scotland have developed a brick. A type of brick. It looks just like an ordinary house brick, same size, same shape, same colour, if you like. And it's made not out of clay, but out of demolition waste or general construction waste. It's basically hardcore, which is ground down to a certain size, and it's mixed with waste plasterboard, so gypsum from the plasterboard, and that, again, is another serious waste issue. It's mixed with that and some secret ingredient that they're not telling me about. You stick it into a mold, some sort of machine that they've developed. You switch the machine on. Actually, I think the machine's going all the time. You just tip the stuff into a hopper. And bricks come out of the other end. And this is all done without having to dig clay out of the ground in clay pits, and without having to form it into bricks and then fire it in a kiln at about 1300 degrees Celsius. So it's very, very efficient in terms of materials usage. It's a way of dealing with waste stream, which is always an issue on site. And of course, it's a very low carbon process because you don't have to burn loads of fossil fuels in order to get your kiln up to this temperature. It doesn't even contain cement, which is an interesting thing. I assumed that the secret ingredient was probably ordinary Portland cement or something like that, but it's not, they tell me. It's something completely different. There is no cement in it either. And of course, cement is the biggest emitter of carbon, I think, in the human endeavour. It's our biggest contribution to global warming, really, cement.
Well, I posted a piece this morning on the Construction Index website about cement-free concrete. This product's been around, called Cemfree. It's been around for a while and increasingly being tested in different places. And it's been used on the viaduct repair job on the M25, it's somewhere in Essex, where they've, in this concrete uses ground granulated blast furnace slag, which is the waste product from the blast furnaces, from that steel production. And that goes instead of cement, which, as you say, is the big carbon bad guy. And this alternative cement-free concrete is therefore 70%, I think they claim, has 70% less carbon per ton than regular, ordinary Portland cement.
Okay.
Now, I don't know the economics. I don't know whether you're paying extra. With these bricks, does it make, as a purchaser, are you paying more for them? Presumably there's an upfront cost in the early development and later they'll be cheaper. I don't know.
There must be. Do you know what? I don't know how they compare cost-wise with traditional bricks. I imagine at the moment they must be more expensive because obviously they're not producing them in appreciable quantities, although they have quite a lot of interest from the industry, apparently.
Who are they? Who's doing this?
The name of the company is Kenotek, K-E-N-O-T-E-Q. It's a spin-off from Heriot Watt University.
I thought it was a university, Heriot Watt, right.
It is Heriot Watt University. They developed it. There was a Professor Madero who's been working on this for 10 years, apparently, and she's a civil engineer and an environmental engineer, and she was determined to find a way of using this waste material. She wanted to find a way that it could be used for more than just type 1 fill, which is obviously what your demolition waste is often used for. It's screened and then it's just used to fill voids in excavations. She wanted to make something, she wanted to add value to it. So she developed this brick, and they've commercialized it. They've spun off this business called Kenotek. The product, by the way, is called the K-Brick, B-R-I-Q. But I imagine that there are benefits, quite apart from it will make you look very good environmentally if you're using a K-brick.
Well, good luck to them.
Obviously is, yeah.
I say good luck to them. It sounds like another move in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Talking of moving in directions.
On to the news about smart motorways, which broke this week. Smart motorways, of course. The whole idea is to reduce congestion and make motorways safer. Obviously, we've got a lot more traffic on the motorways now. We can't keep building them or making them wider. We have to somehow manage the flow. So the whole idea of a smart motorway is that it's constantly monitored and traffic density is managed by using variable speed limits and that kind of thing. And hopefully the idea is that, well, the idea definitely is that you keep the traffic moving even during peak hours. But there are safety concerns which have recently emerged. In fact, there was a BBC Panorama programme this week, wasn't there, about it. There has actually been a huge increase in near misses and I think even in deaths. Is that correct?
The increase in deaths, there have been 38 deaths is what we were told on smart motorways in the past 5 years, I think the figure is. The more stunning comparator is a 20-fold increase in near misses in this stretch of the M25 that was looked at. And Highways Agency say that their Highways England, forgive me, as they are now called, say that their number one priority is safety. Well, clearly that's not true. Their number one priority is keeping traffic flowing. If their number one priority was safety, they'd shut every motorway, because obviously driving carries a risk. We want to do it. We want motorways open. Anyway, the whole point of the reason why these smart motorways came into existence was twofold. One, in the 80s, we had a massive motorway widening program, which became enormously controversial because of the amount of land that was required to be the expansion of land and making motorways bigger. It was opponents of it said that all it was doing was generating more traffic. Then the second element was that they became technology that enabled to catch speeding motorists without a policeman in his car or her car. Now, you put the two things together with smart motorway. What it does is, by getting rid of the hard shoulder, which is a dumb idea in anyone's book, but getting rid of the hard shoulder, you effectively are widening the motorway and therefore you're increasing capacity. You mitigate that by putting in technology which, one, spots, radars can detect immediately a car's in trouble, and the rescue vehicles swoop into action and minutes later will rescue you, the theory goes. And two, the technology also has these variable dot matrix boards on gantries, overhead gantries, which flash up temporary speed restrictions, because the technology can detect how traffic is flowing and it can sense that if everyone travelled at 55 miles an hour for this stretch of road, we'd all get there a lot quicker than all travelling at 70, braking at 2 miles up ahead has that knock-on effect where ripple back and suddenly you're standing still in traffic and you don't understand why, because there's no obstruction up ahead. It's just stop-start congested traffic. Better that everyone moves a little slower, steadier, gets there quicker, uses less petrol, less emissions, we're back on that again, and it's just all round better and more sensible. This Panorama programme declares, which I didn't know, is that only 25 miles out of the 400 miles of smart motorway actually has the radar that detects the broken down cars that just stuck. So you've got cars breaking down, no safe place to go to, because they were meant to be, I think it was 600 metres apart, these lay-bys, these refuge areas, sort of mini hard shoulders, and they ended up being up to 2.5 miles apart.
But that was the justification for getting rid of the hard shoulder, wasn't it?
Exactly. Don't worry.
The hard shoulder is there for your safety.
Yes.
If you get rid of it, you need to replace it with something. And the idea was that you had these lay-bys, these safe refuges,
coupled with the radar, technology to find you when you're helped. But and what happens now, of course, is the rescue vehicles can't get to you. If you're stuck in traffic, big tailback behind, there's no hard shoulder for the police or the AA man to zoom up the inside, up the hard shoulder, because that ain't there. And Edmund King, the president of the AA Foundation, who's been part of the wise voice of road motoring and road building and everything to do with traffic policy for as long as I've been writing about the subject, he's saying that it now takes an average of 34 minutes to be rescued. If you break down on a smart motorway, it will take an average of 34 minutes, half of that time for anyone to realise you've broken down, half that time for the emergency services to get to you. And so for more than half an hour, he said on his Panorama programme, he said very graphically, you're a sitting duck.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of listeners would probably agree with me when I say I hadn't noticed that the motorways have become any smarter since they introduced these smart motorways. I suppose I rationalise that by assuming that you don't know whether it's a smart motorway or not until you actually have an emergency, and then the proof is in the pudding. You know, if it's a smart motorway, you're rescued immediately. Well, as you say, if that's not the case, it's not really a smart motorway, is it?
Well, I thought the smart motorways are the automatic temporary speed limits coming up. The induction loops, or whatever they're called, can sense how fast the traffic, or how the traffic is flowing. And it automatically puts up, hey, whether that's automatic or there's someone sitting in a control box near Spaghetti Junction, I don't know. But I've often been on motorways where there've been restricted speed limits. I mean, almost always on parts of the M25.
Yes.
But it was an eye-opener to me that the radar detection was virtually non-existent. I always thought the key feature of smart motorways, or the one which modified my driving behaviour, was that there's cameras everywhere, and if it said 70 and you did 80, you were going to get a ticket. If it said 50 and you did 60, you were going to get a ticket automatically. Rather like driving through the Dartford Bridge or Dartford Tunnels between Kent and Essex. The technology there knows vehicle recognition technology, it knows who you are, and it will catch up with you if you haven't got an online account, which anyone who does it regularly will have,
indeed.
Or if you don't go online and pay the toll reasonably promptly afterwards. And I assumed that the M25 had that sort of vehicle recognition technology to catch speeding motorists. I now no longer know that's the case. Because I've long had a suspicion that the secret hidden agenda for smart motorways was all about privatisation of the motorway network. Because if you read an interview that Graham Dalton, the former chief executive of Highways England, who was instrumental in turning Highways England into, instrumental in turning Highways Agency into Highways England. He wanted it to be a standalone company so that they weren't bound by civil service rules, and he wanted to be able to, you know, pay the top staff should be allowed to earn more money and not be capped at civil service pay limits. And he, interview he gave to the Civil Service World magazine at the time, he was saying the problem with the highway network, the motorway network, is that it had no direct revenue stream from customers. Now, if you suddenly have a system like they've got at the Dartford crossings, where if you haven't paid your toll online, you haven't paid your subscription, your license fee or whatever, the system, the technology knows that you haven't, and you'll get fined. I've always assumed that Smart Motorway eventually was the gateway to privatisation, or at least direct tolls. Whenever I've asked this question of Highways England, they'll say, that's not government policy. If you want to know about government policy, ask the Department for Transport. Ask the Department for Transport. they won't answer that question. And I've asked the question, what's the difference between the technology that gathers traffic information on smart motorways and the technology that gathers traffic information on the Dartford crossing? And you get an answer back that something like, we work closely with our suppliers to provide the best possible technology for our policy, and our policy is to keep traffic moving and to save lives. And you cannot, I have yet failed to get a proper answer to that question, so I'm still suspicious, hugely cynical of smart motorways, and it's always been a mad idea to get rid of the hard shoulders. Change of subject. Did you see those photos in the papers of that construction site in China where they're building the hospital to tackle the coronavirus outbreak?
Yes, I certainly did. In fact, we are going to be using one of those photographs in the next issue of the magazine, which is out next month. A really remarkable aerial photograph looking directly down on this site in Wuhan where they're building this hospital, or actually have probably built it by now.
Look like a muddy field. Go on.
I counted 38 excavators, all different sorts. It looked like a sort of a piece of modern art, because it didn't, to begin with, it looked like somebody had scattered a load of electric guitars on a brown bedspread or something like
that.
That's
exactly what I thought, a muddy field full of dead guitars.
Yeah, really strange. And there they were. The story is that, obviously, listeners will know about the coronavirus outbreak in China and Wuhan, this enormous city of, I think, 11 million people is at the centre of this outbreak. And they've got to move quickly because they're anticipating a huge influx of people who are sick with this virus. And so the Chinese government has decided it's going to build not one, but actually two new hospitals. I think they've already built one, or if they haven't built it, it's nearing completion.
They'll have built it by the time most people listen to this, I suspect.
Yeah, I think so.
6 days?
Six days to build a 1,000-bed hospital and actually start treating patients, which is quite remarkable.
How big?
Admittedly, they use...
I don't know how big a 1,000-bed hospital is, but it must be as big as Leeds General or Birmingham. It's a major city hospital.
25,000 square metres, I believe. Maybe, I don't know if that's the size of the floor space of the hospital.
I'm trying to think of that in old money. That's about 250,000 square feet, isn't it, roughly speaking?
Yeah, yeah. It's enormous. Oof. And I believe they're using off-site manufacture, or what we like to call prefabrication, to obviously speed up the...
No, you got it the wrong way around. They're using prefabrication, but we like to call it off-site manufacturing.
That is correct, yes. Yeah, well, whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, obviously, that's just the shell of the building. They've got to put in all the mechanical and electrical installations, all the plumbing and the drainage. How long did it take for a concrete slab to actually reach final strength? 6 days seems like an awfully short period of time. But that's what they're doing. And this photograph that we're publishing is one of many. I mean, it was a very difficult decision to decide which of these photographs we were going to use. We used this one because of its abstract appeal, I suppose. But pictures taken from ground level showing this forest of excavator arms, and they're all different colours, all different manufacturers, most of them Korean or Japanese, incidentally, not Chinese. Obviously, anybody who had a digger within a certain radius of Wuhan was drafted in. But it's quite remarkable when you see, because what they were doing, they were clearing the site, levelling the site. There's a few bulldozers in there, just a handful, about 12. They were levelling the site and then they were basically blinding it with gravel and aggregate ready for the slab to go down. So all these excavators, I assume, were just there to level the site and distribute the aggregate. But they're all well within each other's radius. And I just thought this was really bizarre and a recipe for disaster, because if you've got an excavator with, say, an 8-meter reach, and you've got two more excavators within 6 meters of you.
And they're all 360 degree slewing these machines, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Quite bizarre. I mean, obviously, they must be very skilled and very vigilant operators. But there they were, and they're just sort of knuckling down and getting this done as quickly as possible. And as I say, they were going to do it in 6 days, and I think the sixth day is tomorrow, so we'll find out probably whether or not they've managed to do it. But it is remarkable when the chips are down that you can actually mobilise and organise the construction of such a huge project and start it and complete it in less than a week. It seems hardly credible.
Well, over the past 30 years, as we know, China has just done an extraordinary amount of infrastructure development at breakneck speed. I mean, the rate at which they put up power stations and railways and big bridges and motorways, it's unbelievable. It's been 15 years or more since I last went to China, but there was a period of time over 10 years around the millennium I was there every year or so, and each time I went, it was just fewer and fewer bicycles and more big shiny cars and higher buildings, and the place, you know, turned from paddy fields to Las Vegas in a blink of an eye. The development is extraordinary. What I do wonder is what chickens may come home to roost in 20 years' time, or perhaps already have done, in terms of build quality. We have enough problems in this country with all sorts of building regulations and building control and putting things up, and yet we can't do things properly, and we think we do things slowly, carefully, well regulatedly and consideredly, and everything, you know, checked off and certified.
Yes.
So if they can do it without the problems that we've had, I'd be surprised.
It is incredible, actually, and it's hard to understand from where we are, because of course we're talking about how we have this problem of housing. We haven't got enough houses and we can't build them fast enough. I can't remember how many houses we managed to build last year, but not enough. And yet, you know, you can build a hospital in 6 days in China. We can't even build a terrace of houses here in a year.
Oh, no, they can't. No, there are many people. There are growing numbers of people who will tell you that they can build your house in 3 days now by using modern methods of construction, prefabrication, building it off-site, craning it into place and plugging it in. Latest one being in the news this morning, St Modwen development, where they put up their first two modular homes. And the chief executive of St Modwen Homes was waxed lyrical about their architectural qualities, and it was a prestige product to have the, it looked perfectly normal, nothing bad, nothing good, terraced home to me, 3 stories, 4 bedrooms, good size. I didn't see it as an architectural marvel that he seemed to be suggesting. But the point being is that it's 6 loads on the back of a truck from a factory, craned into place, bosh, a few days later, 2 houses.
I mean, they look like perfectly fine houses to me. I don't know why St Modwen is making a big noise about this, because prefabricated housing isn't anything new, and most of the volume house builders, you know, they build a few modular houses or prefabricated houses. Some of them more enthusiastically than others. Most of them prefer to use the traditional brick and block on-site methods.
Well, the degrees of prefabrication, of course, the idea of a timber frame or a roofing framework that you lift on top of your brick walls is well established. So you can use this componentry that's made off-site and brought in, and then you've got your whole unit fully fitted with your bathroom, the doors and windows already in place, and the taps, and almost your IKEA pictures on the wall, in some cases, it seems, already brought in. It's just bosh done.
Yes. And these Synodwyn houses, were they the latter sort, or were they the former?
The latter, six modules. And just all you do is you plug in the pipes to the, you know, attach it to the sewers and the mains and the phone cables or whatever. You have still got to build foundations for them, so there's an element of site work that you can't avoid.
But they appear to have brick walls and slate roofs. So, I mean, are those just panels which are bolted on afterwards, or are they actually stuck on by hand on site?
It sounds, I don't know whether the roof is a separate model, but it sounded like it's ready attached, because there wasn't much connecting to be done once they got on site.
How remarkable. Well, I suppose, it's something to shout about. Be interesting to see if they decide that that's how they're going to build all their houses.
Well, what they didn't say was whether that was for a private sale, or it was social housing, or for rental use, because a lot of the prestige developers, I mean, we're used to seeing, for example, pods in high-rise apartment blocks, or more particularly in student
hotels,
exactly, in student accommodation blocks, where all the bathrooms are identical, and you can see they've got, if you look up to the ceiling and down to the floor, they've got sort of rounded edges, molded, formed pods, which are the bathrooms. And this has been standard. I mean, McDonald's were a big player in standardising that. The reason why all McDonald's look and feel the same is because they're all built in a factory and arrive on site and built in no time at all. It's ultimate factoryisation. And that was taken on to some of the travel lodges and those sort of more budget hotel type of hotels. And more hotels have been doing it. And that came from that into the social housing and build-to-rent accommodation tower blocks. What you're not yet seeing is that sort of technology being used by very much, too much, in the homes marketed at the private house buyer in the more expensive private homes, because there's still seen to be personal specification and hand-built. It still seem to be to carry a premium.
Yeah. It is interesting, but I think you're right that it's not a cure-all. I mean, I think that prefabrication has its role, and I think it can be very useful, but it's not suitable for every type of building. It's not suitable for every customer.
I think the modular the prefab housing companies, the biggest hurdle they've got to overcome is not the market resistance from the likes of you and I that don't trust snot and cardboard houses, and that's our prejudicial attitude to that, and that can be overcome just in fullness of time by seeing them and as they get better. But the bigger hurdle for them is the mortgage providers, who are not terribly keen to lend for these, because they actually don't yet know what the design life is, or what the what the functional real life of these buildings is. And there is conservatism, reticence, I think, from the mortgage lenders, and that's yet to be overcome.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Okay, that's it from this week's episode of Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you now can. If you're listening via Apple Podcast, you can leave a review, or you can email us. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. That's podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. David and I will be back again next week. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagent's UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.